We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Most people, I expect, if asked to name the person responsible for the idea of evolution, will say Charles Darwin. However, if you go back something like 150 years, you will see another man standing, perhaps not literally standing, but standing beside Darwin, a man named Alfred Russel Wallace. At the time, both were considered to be joint discoverers of the theory of evolution. So why today does everyone know about Darwin, but almost no one remembers Wallace? In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Roy Davies. He is an author, documentary producer, someone who has had a long career with the BBC, and he's the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is The Darwin Conspiracy, and in the book, he makes the argument that Darwin took some key ideas from Wallace, did not give him credit, and was involved in marginalizing him in the process. He's here visiting the campus. He gave a talk last night as part of the Chancellor's Colloquium on Evolution, Biology, and Beyond. And we'll be talking a little bit about that with one of the people who organized this colloquium. He's here also with us in the studio, Carl Woese. He's professor of microbiology in the School of Molecular and Cellular Biology here at the University of Illinois. So as we talk, as always, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief as possible, so we can accommodate as many callers as possible to keep things moving along, but certainly callers are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions, comments are welcome. Well, Roy Davies,
hello, Dave.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Professor Woese, thanks very much for being here. I think the place to start here is for me to ask Roy Davies to talk a little bit about Alfred Russel Wallace.
Alfred Russel Wallace, an amazing man, nothing less. He was born on the borders of England and Wales in 1923 and basically had a very real interest in natural history from the time that he was around 14, when he was a surveyor looking at lands in Wales, primarily with a view to turning the common land into owned by landowners. And he was upset by this. He was a socialist at the heart. And basically, within a short time, he'd been introduced to the idea of beetles and became fascinated as a naturalist, so that he began his own collection. And shortly afterwards, he met a man called Henry Walter Bates in England, who taught him more, and they both decided in 1848 to go to the Amazon collecting species together with a view to solving the origin of species. That was Alfred Wallace. Mm.
To jump ahead here to something, a critical event that took place in, I believe, the year was 1858, which is the central argument that you make in the book. There was a correspondence between Wallace and Darwin. Wallace wrote to Darwin, laying out some of his ideas about evolution and natural selection. The argument that you're making is that, contrary to the story that we have always heard, that at this point, Darwin had essentially been sitting on his ideas for a couple of decades, and that it was this letter that prompted him finally to rush into print. The argument you're making is that, in fact, his ideas weren't that well organized, and that, and I think not to put up too fine a point on it, you say that Darwin stole the idea from Wallace, made it appear as if he had had the idea himself sometime before. That's the essence of your book.
It's part of the essence of the book, and it's the crucial final part, if you like, of the bottling of the essence. Essentially, what had happened was that in that particular incident, Darwin rushed to write The Origin of Species after receiving Wallace's letter containing the full theory of evolution in less, just over 4,000 words. And that's the end of the story. The start of the story goes back a long way because Wallace and Darwin had been corresponding for at least 3 years before this. Mm-hmm. And Wallace had sent Darwin a letter in 1856 expressing all his ideas. And it was then that Darwin's theory changed from being one which was rather outlandish that he'd held for the previous 14 years into the theory that you find now, or the theory that you only partially find now in The Origin of Species. Mm-hmm. And that theory is the theory we're now accustomed to and familiar with of natural selection and the idea that all species have descended from a basic ancestor by modifying themselves as they go, and therefore we've resulted in the millions of species we have on the planet at the moment. But that was in Origin of Species, but in fact those ideas were not Darwin's before 1857. In fact, mm-hmm. he had no idea of some of those ideas before 1857.
Now, there has been a good deal of controversy generated by this book. Yes. There are some people who feel that you're not correct in this argument, and they, I think, have said that one can go back and look at Darwin's work and Darwin's writing before this point, certainly before this famous letter of 1858, and find in his writing the theory of evolution. They would say, oh, it was there.
I know. That's what they say. But those people haven't been back to the original sources to find out exactly what Darwin was talking about at that time. In fact, there was nothing about evolution in Darwin's work. Certainly before a few ideas started to emerge in 1845. But even then, they were nothing like the ideas that we now know of as the theory of evolution. In fact, the people who trot out these ideas, and many of them are academics, just haven't gone back to the original sources themselves, and they are repeating ideas that other people have put into books before them, particularly because Charles Darwin was an amazing spin doctor. He actually told people what he had done, and they, believing him, actually used his comments about his own work to make him seem as if he had all these ideas himself.
There, I also want to talk about the actions of two individuals who were friends of Darwin, mm-hmm. Charles Lyell and Joseph Hooker, who organized a reading of papers by Darwin and by Wallace. Mm-hmm. Neither man was there. Wallace was off in the field collecting, and I think Darwin was at his house, but he could have been there, I suppose, but he wasn't. And the idea seemed to be that here are these two men, here are their ideas, we're going to present these. You also seem to be arguing, though, that this event was constructed to make an unequal kind of presentation here, really, to say that, well, yes, we have two men and two ideas, but one set and one man was more important than the other.
It's difficult. It's not difficult in practical terms. It's difficult in theoretical terms to put before an audience exactly what these two men were talking about. But what had happened was that Charles Lyell was Darwin's patron, and Darwin was his protege. And Hooker was his very best friend. They'd written to each other almost every day throughout the time that they'd known each other, from 1841 all the way through to 1858. And so they knew each other intimately and their thoughts. And the reason why the Linnaean Society meeting on July the 1st, 1858, was such a travesty was that Charles Lyell and Hooker knew how weak Darwin's theory had been in the early years, certainly before 1857. And yet not one of them actually allowed themselves to tell the truth at the Linnaean Society. They allowed the whole audience of their peers, gentlemen, to believe that, in fact, Darwin had had the same theory that he was suggesting in 1858 all the way back to 1838, and they knew that was untrue. And so by not telling the truth at this meeting, they allowed Darwin's name to go in front of Wallace, whose paper was read at this meeting, and it was the total and complete theory of evolution, whereas Darwin could only produce three extracts from an essay that he'd written in 1844 and a letter to a Harvard botanist called Asa Gray, who had sent Darwin a reply saying that he effectively thought his ideas were grievously hypothetical. So, in fact, Darwin presented this as if he'd sent a letter with his new ideas, Gray had accepted them, and that put together with two ideas from his basic essay, saying that Malthus had been his inspiration and that he'd had the idea of natural selection 20 years before. And those three pieces of evidence were put against against Wallace's total theory of evolution. Mm. And so Darwin's name went first because he was a gentleman and Wallace was a worker. Wallace was a workman and, quite honestly, a gentleman always trumped a workman in England in 1857, 58, as in many cases the class system in England does to this day.
Now, I wanted to tell people listening that we are greatly simplifying an argument that you make in some detail in the book, The Darwin mm-hmm. Conspiracy. I do also want to mention, and I didn't, is that there's a website for the book, and if anyone would like to read it, mm-hmm. they may download it for free.
Absolutely.
So the book is available, and I would urge people, if this sounds interesting to you, you know, read the book and read it more closely, and you will get a deeper sense of the argument than we have time to do here. But just as one small further question, and you began to answer that, one would wonder if you were sitting there in the audience and you were hearing this, and that one set of ideas seemed to be more completely developed than the other, why everyone didn't stand up and start cheering and say, well, this fellow Alfred Russel Wallace, he's really got something here. Partly it had to do with the respective relative social classes of the two men.
Oh, absolutely. And don't forget, Wallace wasn't there, as you say, because he was still collecting in the Far East. Darwin wasn't there because he had a tragedy at home. His young son had just died of scarlet fever. But Lyell and Hooker were there. And Lyell hadn't been to a meeting of the Linnaean Society for 5 years. Hooker had never been to one for 12 months, and yet they were the first two names on the list. And I don't believe that there's a possibility that the two of them had not in some way allowed members to think that in fact Darwin's paper was the equivalent of Wallace's Ternate essay. And there's no proof of that. But certainly it was a put-up job. And the fact that the audience did not respond is one thing. But one man said, who was professor at the at Trinity College Dublin, he said, what is new here, you know, is not surprising. And what is old has been heard many times before. And his was the only judgment from anyone in the audience about hearing this essay. I think basically it came, you see, after six other papers had been read. I think they were all rather tired. And to hear a theoretical essay read out, you know, late in the afternoon on a very hot summer's day in England, just didn't lend itself to people being either totally attentive or perhaps not even awake. You know,
I have some callers here. I promise I will get to them in a moment. But I want to bring Professor Wallace into the conversation. And bring us up, if you can, to where we are now. And the question obviously is, well, if this in fact is what happened, if Roy Davies is correct, it certainly does not reflect well on Darwin. Does that cause us to think differently about him, about his ideas, about evolution?
I take a very dark view of Darwin, that whole era, because my feeling is that all that we hear about evolution in the 19th century was pre-scientific and has nothing to do with the real study of evolution. Now, I say this based upon 45 years of experience as an evolutionist. The key thing that has caused the resurgence in the study of evolution is the technology developed by another Englishman, Frederick Sanger, for sequencing macromolecules, and you hear this all over the place. After that technology was developed, or as it was being developed, I myself got into the game, and it allowed one not only to look at organisms that we can see and touch, but it allowed one to look at microorganisms. Mm-hmm. And at that point, there was a new study of evolution happening, which was not informed by Darwin. It is of its own generation, and it is in the microbial world, involving molecules. And as far as I'm concerned, the scientific study of evolution didn't start until after mid-century, 20th century.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that you wouldn't argue, people would not argue that Darwin was not an important figure in the history of science. But do you think that there is too much in the discussion of evolution, particularly in popular media, there's too much concentration on Darwin the individual and perhaps not enough on other people of his time who contributed or what's been done since?
Darwin is not an important figure in the history of science. Evolution would have developed without his ever being born. There were a number of people involved. Wallace himself was a contemporary, of course, but there was Patrick Matthew, who was working in 1831, and there was another person who should have been celebrated this year, 2009. That is Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who published his famous work, Philosophie Zoologique, exactly in 2009. And you don't hear mention of this man, even though he is given credit for being the first real academic evolutionist.
Our guest, let me introduce again our guest in this part of Focus 580. Here in the studio with us, and we have Carl Woese. He's professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois, and also Thomas Davies. He's a former producer for the BBC. He is here on the campus to give a talk. He gave a talk yesterday, part of the Chancellor's Colloquium on Evolution, Biology, and Beyond, something that Professor Woese was involved in organizing. And if you're interested in reading the book that we just talked a little bit about here that Roy Davies has written, The Darwin Conspiracy. If you there's a website for the book, go to darwinconspiracy.co.uk and you can download the book for free if you would like to read it. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with the first, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Yes.
Very interesting topic, Mr. Davies. I was at your talk last night, and I've read through your book. Need to spend more time with it. Yes, it does make Wallace look like a very interesting character, someone who deserves more study. But I wanted to say something about the differences between Wallace and Darwin in the larger picture of evolution. And they did have some differences in their views. One was on the function of Lamarckian inheritance of acquired characters. This is something that Wallace rejected. Darwin really did not. And one way of looking at this is, in this sense, Wallace was right about this and Darwin was not. But if you look at two other areas, for example, if you look at the role of sexual selection, this is something that Darwin recognized its importance. Wallace did not. So that's the advantage of Darwin. And another big one was looking at the evolution of man. Darwin applied natural selection throughout the animal kingdom, including man. Wallace talked about an overruling intelligence, something we would call intelligent design, or creationism, to explain man. So we have Darwin moving from a supernatural to a natural explanation of the origin of all species, and we have Wallace moving from a natural to a supernatural explanation. So that seems to be a big point in favor of Darwin. So I wish could you comment a little bit on the larger picture, which may be a bit peripheral to your thesis, but I still think it's interesting to consider when we have to think about the position of these two men in scientific history.
Sure. I think that's a very fair question. And while my book doesn't go beyond the Linnaean Society meeting of 1858, obviously I've got some thoughts on the rest of Wallace's and Darwin's career. Basically, your two points are the three points. One, we agree that Wallace was ahead in one, and Darwin may have phased him in the other two. But let's talk about the other two. Let's take the third one first. The whole idea of Darwin's ability to talk about man as part of the species kingdom, seemingly Wallace not. Well, that's an error. And sadly, people don't know enough about Wallace to know that it's an error. In 1857, Wallace replied to Darwin's letter that he received in response to his own of 1856. So it was Wallace's second letter to Darwin. And he had been on the Aru Islands in the East Indian Malay archipelago, right next door to New Guinea. And in the letter he sent to Darwin, he was explaining his thoughts on how these islands had been separated from Australia over many, many eons. And he said, I've been looking while I'm here at some of the tribes people, and I find that the human condition here is something that interests me. And the whole question of how the whole origin of species includes man. And he was obviously, because he'd been studying the orangutan, obviously for many years before this, and he had many thoughts on this. And he had actually used the orangutan in one letter to say, I don't know whether man has descended from the orangutan or whether, in fact, the orangutan has descended from man. And Darwin, in reply to this letter from Wallace, said, I really cannot discuss man as part of the species work I'm doing. I think the matter, I'm paraphrasing here, I think the matter is far too complicated for me to get into at this time. Now, this was 1857, 1858. And so by the time that they got to the Linnaean Society of 1858, there was no question but that Darwin had no indication at all that man was part of his thought process in terms of the theory of evolution. I don't know if you want to come back on that before I talk to the other point.
Yeah, well, but if you go further on, then Darwin, of course, writes about the descent of man and totally with a natural perspective, and Wallace goes on to say that there's some overruling intelligence that's responsible for man.
Sure.
Not a scientific perspective at all.
No, I just come back on that one. Yeah, the point was that once the argument goes past July 1858, Wallace has already indicated what he thinks, and he thinks as man is part of the animal kingdom, and therefore his whole Ternate essay is based on man and animals and species generally. After 1858 and 59, when the Origin of Species is written by Darwin, you'll find nothing about man in there. And that's the point at which this whole theory hit the world. Later, obviously, in thinking about it, Darwin was able to use man as part of the animal kingdom, but he wasn't able to do it up until the time he wrote The Origin of Species. The other point you make about Wallace flipping over more or less to thinking things that he certainly had never thought about while he was writing his Ternate essay. Yes, he seemed to start thinking of sort of outlandish things, and even bringing spiritualism and maybe the possibility of God, because he couldn't work out in terms of evolution how this could work, and he was musing about it. But in fact, that all came a long time after the theory of evolution. Whether or not the two men changed sides and thoughts after that, it's pretty well irrelevant to the story that I tell, although obviously it's intriguing to find that one man moves one way and one the other.
Yeah, I think Professor Wallace would like to add on.
I wanted to say one thing about sexual selection. Yes, Darwin was the first perhaps to suggest sexual selection, that by which I mean Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather. And he writes clearly in his writings that there is sexual selection is very important.
Well, I hope that gets at your question. I have some others here I want to get on to. I just want to come back to one point with Roy Davies here. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about one reason perhaps that Wallace was marginalized was that he was a working-class man, mm-hmm. and he was not a gentleman, and the other scientists were, and that they felt that he was certainly not of their class or of their club. Could it also be the case that since then, more modern scientists have tended to take Wallace perhaps less seriously for the very reasons that you just cite?
Oh, I say this in the book. I claim there are two conspiracies here. Two conspiracies. The first conspiracy is the Charles Lyell and Hooker at the Linnaean Society. That was definitely a conspiracy. It was a skullduggery, as Janet Brown says in her book. The second one is the fact that all these facts have been in the public domain for more than 40 years. And not one of the academics who have written books about Wallace have, or Darwin, have ever gone back to these sources to use them. And now, why not? What is the problem here? Why am I a sort of a hack journalist come producer in the BBC, you know, whatever? Why am I the only person to have gone back and found these things sitting there? And it's because the writers of the books on Darwin and Wallace are pretty well the descendants of the idea of Darwin being first all the way through the university system. Mm. And the people who are writing the textbooks go not for the basic documents. They don't go back. What they do is to repeat what their professors and the teachers have told them before. And that, to a certain extent, is exactly why Wallace is not known more than years and why Darwin's story keeps on being burnished and polished by various professors down through the ages. And it's basically because when it first started, this whole story, they did not believe that a working man deserved the kind of respect, hence Wallace's name coming second in the pecking order. Darwin had all sorts of doctorates and things out behind his name, and Wallace had none, not one, and it mattered.
I just wonder what, Professor Wallace, you'd think about this this idea that perhaps more recent, more modern, contemporary scientists have discounted Wallace, maybe not for the same reasons he was discounted in his time, but have discounted him.
Darwin is, for me, the Darwin we see talked about is a social construct. He is of no value to science, because evolution was there to be formulated roughly by the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And whether Darwin had lived or not made no difference. But what Darwin had done that was very useful to the times was he had structured his book, Origin of Species, so that it could be viewed as a drawing a dichotomy between being an atheistic scientist and being a religious person who was some kind of kook. That has nothing to do with any real study of evolution. There's no discipline in science, in basic science, that sets out to ask the question, is there a God? And evolution does, and a decent science of evolution doesn't ask that question. It has been thrown in as some sort of sociological nostrum, in which then social systems can be built. I mean, what do you see in this year? You see people, all these discussions about the existence of God or not. Well, there should be no discussions about the existence of God if you're going to celebrate evolution. It's just like celebrating physics with Einstein or something. Mm-hmm. So I don't hold with this. I say there's sort of, let's call it, a third way. You don't have to be a believer or not a believer to be a scientist. That's well received at the basic levels of all science. So I don't like it when they count those who believe in God and those who don't believe in evolution and somehow equate them. They're totally separate.
Let's talk with some other callers here. Let's go to line number two. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Class seems to play a big role in the writing of history. Not only Wallace, but Lamarck was also a victim of class and was, his legacy has been very distorted, and I think in many respects even to this day, the lies that were told about what his theories actually were. But I'm curious to get your response to, I'm assuming you probably saw a recent PBS special on Darwin, and they, go to great lengths to tell this story of how, gentlemanly he was about this whole business and how he made, he was very concerned about disparaging Wallace, and he did everything he could to make sure that Wallace was treated fairly, but he had come to this already, and that he was unlike what you're putting forth here, he was just he hadn't told anybody, but he had all this stuff already lined up. And I'm just wondering, your response to that, that's to this day still, putting that forth.
Yeah, that was one PBS special in America. I didn't see it, but I can imagine the story being told was pretty well familiar to what I've been hearing for many years. What you don't know is that in the UK, where I live, we might have had 22 different programs on Darwin this year, radio, television, internet, whatever. And a huge amount of money has been spent, and every one of the programs has reiterated exactly the same story that PBS told.
They really seem to spend a lot of energy, defending or at least, trying to make the case for Darwin being very upstanding and, so concerned about doing right by Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
He really, really fretted over not doing anything underhanded or being perceived to be doing anything.
Okay. There's one aspect of this which you probably don't know, I've not touched on before, is that when Wallace came back to this country, or to our country rather, in 1862, he came back and, of course, he was celebrated as one of the two people who had come up with the theory of evolution. His name was tied with Darwin. He was absolutely over the moon. You can imagine a man who spent the days collecting beetles in forests suddenly, theoretically, was seen as one of the two cleverest people on the subject in the world. So he was delighted and overcome. But then he applied for a job as secretary to the Geological Society in Britain, probably the best possible candidate they could have had. His language was brilliant. His writing was as clear as a bell. His knowledge was better than most people's who'd never, ever been to any of the places he'd been. Turned down. Darwin, was among other people who were aware of Wallace's plight. And then Darwin goes out and tries to get Wallace a pension, and he gets him a £200 a year stipend from the government. And that many people have seen as a guilt trip for Darwin in order to make sure that, Wallace wasn't seen to be going around extremely poor. Whether or not Darwin stood up and felt that Wallace had been badly treated, then you go back to the first volume of The Origin of Species. And what you find there is that Darwin throughout, even though Wallace and he had been seen as joint discoverers, you find all the way through my theory, 43 different times inside the book, he refers to it as my theory. Wallace's name comes up 3 times in the book, not one of them as the co-discoverer of the theory of evolution. And that's Darwin.
We're a bit past the midpoint here. We have some other callers, and I want to thank the last and hope he wouldn't mind if I go on here and also introduce once again our guests. Roy Davies has had a long career as a documentary producer with the BBC. He's now a freelance writer and independent producer. If you'd like to read more of this story that he's been telling this morning, you should look at his book, The Darwin Conspiracy, and it is something that if you have internet access, you can download for free if you go to the website of the book. He's here visiting the campus, gave a talk last night as part of the Chancellor's Colloquium on Evolution, Biology, and Beyond. And also here in the studio with us is Carl Woese. He's professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and one of the organizers of this colloquium. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana in line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Wallace definitely got screwed on this deal. But the thing is that in the 19th century in Britain, the newspaper system was pretty aggressive and pretty antagonistic. If Wallace personally felt like he was getting the shaft, why didn't he go to the press? And secondly, I'd like to mention that about 3 or 4 years ago, if you want to go into the physics, there was, I think they found in Einstein's offices at Princeton, they found a bunch of letters between he and his wife. That his wife had sent him in early, some of the earlier ones were that he had given her the his award for the Nobel Prize. That was part of their divorce agreement. And she would talk to him in the letters about our theory, the theory of relativity. And people picked up on that and wrote books about how she may have been a co-discoverer of the theory of relativity. So I'm wondering if there's any indication of your books like that.
Thanks for the question. No, the one thing that many people who come across suddenly the story of Wallace and Darwin believe is that Wallace ever knew about how he had been, as you call it, shafted, for the rest of his life. Not one person ever explained to him, not Lyle, not Hooker, certainly not Darwin, and they were the only three people who really knew exactly what had happened. So he came back from the Malay Archipelago innocent. He remained innocent. He even wrote a book called Darwinia, which gave, again, the whole theory of evolution and attributed it to Charles Darwin because, as far as he was concerned, Darwin had come up with these ideas independently on his own while Wallace was still in the Malay Archipelago. And so he felt that Darwin should get the tribute. He was a very honest, basic, simple guy. But he wasn't simple in the mind. You know, his brilliant brain, you know, was focused on many other things. He lived his life, and he had a go at the government, and he had a go at, missionaries in the Celebes, and he had a go at the settlers in Australia for the treatment of the Aborigines. I mean, you know, this guy put himself out. What he wasn't was somebody who ever knew, until he died, what had happened to him by Darwin, Hooker, and Lyle.
Yeah, also you mentioned earlier that Wallace was more interested in human evolution and Darwin was less so in the very beginning.
Yes.
I found that interesting because, when you read the Descent of Man from Darwin's point of view, mm-hmm. I'm wondering how much Wallace and he communicated on that. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. And mm-hmm.
Is it just like a conclusion based on, well, if this is, A, B, C, D?
Yeah.
Something to that effect. Also, your other guest was mentioning about this is sort of a social argument, and independently someone else would have found it. And I agree with that implicitly. I think that what Darwin and Wallace did was describe evolution. They didn't discover anything. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Anything you want to add to that, Professor Wells?
No. During the one thing, evolution during the 19th century was, as I said in the beginning, it was nothing but pre-scientific. We had just these collections of facts and ideas. I don't like to use theory because it becomes a very confusing word. Mm. And some were a little more elevated than others, but there was no depth. If one takes natural selection as the foundational statement of a science of evolution, which people do, it doesn't explain anything. The philosopher Karl Popper said it has no explanatory power, has no predictive power. And of course, the nature of theory was his specialty.
Hmm. I'm glad that the caller asked his question because one of the things that I had wanted to ask Roy Davies was about, in fact, the Wallace's reaction or non-reaction that he resisted claims or arguments that other people made in his behalf. I think some people even said, well, really, Alfred, they should call it Wallaceism. They shouldn't call it Darwinism. And Wallace says, no. That's he seemed to push all that away.
Yes.
And you're saying it's because of the fact that not because he was being gracious in a sense, but because he really had no idea what had happened.
He really had no idea. I mean, you're talking here about a time when the gentleman here mentioned about newspapers, when you go to the newspapers. I mean, the newspapers at the time were an entirely different sort of newspaper than we know today. I mean, they were not the sort of gung-ho, let's find out what really happened here sort of newspaper. They were a record newspaper. Mm-hmm. And Wallace himself just had no idea. I mean, and in a way, up until the time that the gold medal was given to himself and Hooker in 1909, right, 50 years after the event, it wasn't until that particular moment, only 4 years before he died when he was 87, did he suddenly realize that some letters that Hooker had written to Darwin were no longer available and they were missing from the archive. And Hooker said, "Well, I don't know anything about this. I really don't." But in fact, what he was onto was Darwin. Wallace didn't ask this question. It came up incidentally. But Hooker said, "No, I don't know what happened to those letters. I really don't know." And what happened was, of course, that all the letters of record between Hooker, Lyle, Darwin, Asa Gray, Wallace, all the letters were missing from the files when they were eventually opened in 1942 up at Cambridge. They were just disappeared.
And you're suggesting, or maybe more than suggesting, is that someone destroyed them.
Absolutely. And Barbara Bedell, who was one of your great researchers, who was very interested in many aspects of the Wallace story, thought that it was Francis Darwin, Darwin's son, who was his biographer. I don't think so. I think she's wrong. I think the person who destroyed all those letters was Charles Darwin.
We have some other callers. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, joining us here in the studio, Carl Rose. He's professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and also Thomas Roy Davies. He's a former BBC producer, writer, author of the book The Darwin Conspiracy. And again, I'd certainly suggest to people to explore this in greater depth. You can read the book for free. You can download it from the website, the Darwin Conspiracy website. So go and do that. We have another caller here, a couple of other callers. So we'll go next to Bloomington, Indiana, and our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Hi. One of your guests said that evolution was not really confirmed until microbiology was developed. I think that assertion is quite wrong. In fact, as greater knowledge of living systems developed, evolution became more and more threatened. For example, Darwin admitted that there were few transitional fossils. He didn't know of any transitional fossils, but he predicted that those transitions would be found. They were never found. In fact, as greater knowledge of living systems developed, evolution was so threatened by the evidence. In other words, it was threatened. It was not validated, and the situation became so serious that by the 1960s there was a special symposium that was convened at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. And at this Wistar Symposium, the biologists tried to defend evolution, but the physical scientists, who were well-versed, they were well-versed in mathematics and probability, and they all denounced evolution because probability showed them that accidental change in a genetic code would never It would never cause consistent genetic improvement. It would cause genetic nonsense, but they said it could never cause consistent genetic improvement.
Well, let's get some response, Professor Wells.
I happen to be the middle author on a paper by Kellen Vetsidian, myself, and Nigel Goldenfeld, my closest collaborator, on exactly this point, the evolution of the genetic code. And if you want to see what we have to say, which comes to the opposite conclusion that you said. Incidentally, Professor Goldenfeld is a top-ranking theoretical physicist, so he could talk to your physicists. If you want to see what we said, I don't know the exact reference, but it was published in Proceedings of the National Academy maybe four or five years ago.
Well, let me quote Dr. Murray Eden, who made a statement at the end of the Wistar Symposium. Dr. Murray Eden was an MIT professor. He was a biologist, but he was also a biophysicist. He wrote a book called Engineering and Living Systems. He was a biophysicist, a biologist, and a physical chemist. He wrote this book called Engineering and Living Systems. And Dr. Eden complained that Darwinists, he said that they depended totally on random variation to produce new species. And he said randomness is utterly insufficient and evolution violates scientific laws. And this is what he said, quote, "An adequate scientific theory of evolution must await the discovery and elucidation of new natural laws," unquote.
Well, I also am a biophysicist, but let me say that the study of complex dynamic systems today is in effect these new laws. Whether you call them laws or not is unimportant, but the principles of complex dynamic physics, which deal with chaotic dynamics and all of that, are where the essence of evolution lies. It's a matter of bringing order out of chaos, and we cannot quote old literature, which I'm saying in the 1960s is old. I only first started publishing then. And we have to see all the new things that are happening in terms of order coming out of chaos. In other words, out of random chance. And that's why I think that the study of evolution is just beginning. It doesn't really have to do with the microbial world per se. It has to do with complex dynamic systems.
We have just I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut in here because we only have about 5 minutes left and I have one other caller. And this is, we're getting into territory that, it, at least for me, is far too complex. Is it possible to say, Professor Willis, something in a relatively simple way about where the study of evolution is headed? Perhaps that's a simple way to ask the question.
Yes, it's headed into the area of physics. That's why I asked for and did receive a joint appointment in the physics department within the last several years. And it's the physicist's formulation of complex dynamic systems that will eventually give us something useful about evolution. We don't know anything about evolution. We keep framing it in these anthropocentric terms of natural selection and all these old language culture that Darwin and early biologists developed. Physics may well be a general principle of the universe, and at that point, you'll be able to talk about the evolution of a supernova and the evolution of some sort of human species or even some family using the same type of language. And that no one realizes that kind of thing is at all possible. But the evolution of the universe is not a separate process from the evolution of anything biological. Evolution is one of the driving principles in the universe, and biology, which we are quite intimately involved with, is only one example of it. But biology is our best window on evolution, and it's not even the human species; it's probably the microbial world.
All right, let's get at least one more caller here. Spring Bay, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. PBS show that was on last week, I believe, was sponsored by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and I think that their sole purpose of existence is to shine light on the lives of scientists. I think that's their main goal. So the question, I suppose, would be, do you think they got it wrong? Secondly, I think Darwin, part of his contribution is he comes up with this idea that heredity and environment create behavior, and it becomes known as a movement of naturalism. It started to become very popular in the social sciences, the arts, and humanities. And I think that still plays significant part in the way we view ourselves today and social scientists and all that. If maybe you could address that, I'll get off the line and listen. Very good program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is that something that you can...
Well, yes, but you can say Lamarck is the source of that. I mean, one of Lamarck's two key points was that organisms have circumstance-suiting power, that the environment shapes the... It's sort of like car companies. I mean, the basic car is there, made by all the car companies. What it's just the trimmings that are different, so that some sort of animal living in the Arctic might be trimmed in white fur because of protection. The same species or genus of organism of animal down in the tropic zones wouldn't be white, but it's the same animal. And Wallace was very 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 keen, but was very attuned to this kind of thing, as was Darwin, and as were the earlier workers like Darwin's grandfather and Lamarck.
The other question, maybe you could just, I think in the sense we've answered the other question that the caller asked, but it goes back to this idea that there has been for a long long time there has been a standard sort of story told about Darwin, about how he came up with the ideas about when and about the relationship between particularly Darwin and Wallace, and that it sounds as if this recent program that has aired here nationally on PBS, which you've said that you didn't see, but just from what people have said, it seems as if you're saying that that's the same – it's the same story.
It's the same story.
And I think actually you once made a documentary some years back about Darwin.
I did.
Where – you told that story, and that now, as a result of the recent work that you've done, you've sort of said, well, you know, I think if I had that to do over again, we would have done that differently.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I was I was editor of a series of programs, and one of my producers brought me this program, and I thought it was an excellent idea, and we made it, and it actually was seen by now by something like 2.5 million people, all of whom now believe, I think, that that Darwin was a genius. And it wasn't until I left the BBC and the woman came to me and said, you know, you told the wrong story, that I actually got around to researching it for myself, right back to the very basic start. And within a short time, I realized I had told the wrong story. And so had my producer to me. And so had the intellectual academic who actually sold him the story. Everybody had the story wrong.
Well, that was, in, I suppose, in fairness to all concerned, that was indeed the prevailing story.
Absolutely.
And there probably weren't, I don't know, maybe there were people who were challenging it, but it sounds like, as if there wouldn't be very many people.
No, there were very, very few people who were challenging it. Yeah. Everybody who's challenged this story has been American.
We're coming to the point here. We have a minute or two left. I'm wanting to come back here to Professor Willis. And again, I'm trying to sort of wrap my brain around this idea that maybe the story of evolution or the scientific investigation of evolution is only just beginning.
Yes.
We're actually in early days. Is it the case that what you're thinking is that in fact, what we have done in the past is we have sketched out a sort of a general framework about what we thought was happening, but that in truly that we couldn't exactly explain how it was happening, and that we're moving toward a point where perhaps we would know in a more precise way what the mechanisms were?
It's the view of evolution that came forth out of the 19th century was just too anthropomorphic. You get the feeling that that evolution applied to biological systems only. And in fact, that's the way academia is set up now. You can study evolution over here in the biology department, a couple of courses, but if you really want to study biology, then you go into the molecular biology and the cell biology and all of that. Well, that's nonsense. Biology is one whole. Evolution is one facet is one aspect of biology, one facet. And then what the molecular biologists study is another, and you can't separate them. And they've been separated now for the better part of 80 years. Now we have to change.
Well, we are at the point where we're going to have to stop because we've exhausted our time. We want to say thanks very much to our guests, Professor Carl Wills. He's professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois. Thank you for being here. And Roy Davies, the author of the book The Darwin Conspiracy and longtime producer for BBC. And again, if you'd like to read the book, it's available for a free download. You go to the website and anyone who is interested in reading the book, it's there and they can read it and spend as much time as they like. Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you. Here.